Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
In the tradition of the Windmill Theatre, whose proud boast was that they never closed throughout the Second World War, Word in Your Ear will not be put off. Will not be put off by pandemics or whatever. We continue in our kind of quest to bring you the finest in kind of musical and literary entertainment, rather than strippers, which is what the Windmill Theatre mainly dealt in. So we're delighted to be able to welcome old friend of the pod, Graham Thompson, to talk about his fantastic new book, Small Hours, The Long Night of John Martin. John Martin, an artist very close to the heart of no doubt lots of people who follow this podcast in its various forms. So here we are. Welcome, Graham. Where do we find you?
Hi, guys. You find me in Edinburgh, still in lockdown north of the border.
You've produced, since I last saw you, a very John Martin-like beard, actually. It's very impressive. Lockdown beard.
This was his character writing, yeah. Took on the role. Not too much, I have to say. The barbers aren't open up here yet, so I'm waiting for next week where we might have a change of style.
Okay, so let's start with the question of Scotland, because you're uniquely well qualified to write this story, because John Martin, the first thing about him is that he's not called John Martin, was he?
No, he was Ian David McGeachy. And Ian with only one I. It's quite often written as IAIN in the Scottish way, but actually it's IAN. I don't know why, because I think he actually adopted the second I. Who knows why? But he was born in Surrey. You know, he's a Southern Englishman by birth. Maybe not by nature, but certainly by birth. And his parents were these light entertainers. They were opera singers. His mother was English. His dad was Scottish. And that marriage fell apart very early on in his life. He was two or three, I think. So, and I guess very unusually for that time, which was the early 50s, he went to live with his dad. So his mum stayed in Surrey. John, or Ian as he was at the time, went up to live with his father and his father's mother in Glasgow. So that's where he was raised. So I think we can claim him kind of as a Scottish artist, but he's English, and all through his life there was this kind of dichotomy, I think.
I was going to say, yeah, was that a tension throughout his life?
Well, I think anyone who's met John, one of the first things he always says, his accent was completely off radar. It was all over the shop. He would talk in sort of hard nut Glasgow. He would talk in quite refined Scottish. He would talk in bish bash bosh Danny Thompson Cockney, East End Cockney. He would talk in Jamaican, when he was with Lee Scratch Perry. There was a massive amount of identity confusion, I think, pretty near the surface. So there was always this, and I think musicians are mimics, they're very good at kind of absorbing sound, and he seemed to absorb personalities as well. So he would take on the character of people he was around. But also I think it's this idea of, he would go down to London every summer, he would spend time with his mom, and so probably trying to kind of fit in with that, he adopted this English persona.
What kind of effect did all that have on him? Because it was a complicated upbringing, wasn't it? As you say, he was kind of abandoned by his mum in some sense, and he only saw her for a couple of weeks or 6 weeks every summer, and he wasn't even allowed to stay with her because his stepdad had never liked him. So what did he feel? I think there's one point, somebody makes the point that might have turned into a bit of a misogynist, the idea that he felt he was abandoned by his mum. Was that true?
Well, that's what he thought, that's what he claimed, and certainly Beverly Martin, his first wife, said that, kind of put those, drew those dots together. But, I suppose there's lots of people who are abandoned by their mothers who don't turn into misogynists and violent people. So, who knows? I can't psychoanalyze them that much. But that was certainly, he said to me, any character flaws I have, are attributable to the divorce of my parents when I was a kid. That's what he felt. Was abandoned. And he would see her, but as you say, he wasn't allowed, his stepfather didn't let him stay in the house, so he would go and stay with his mother's sister. in London. So I think as a young kid, that's probably pretty wounding. But he actually had quite a happy upbringing in Glasgow. You know, he had a huge extended family of aunts and cousins, and he was adored. He was a beautiful-looking boy. And, you know, he was on the surface very happy, I think, in that environment. So, you know, who knows? Nature, nurture and all that.
Right, right. You tell, there's one of the fantastic little vignettes in the book is that when he plays Glasgow quite late in life, his father used to turn up, didn't he?
And rather
make an exhibition of himself from the store.
He did. Yeah, going on about why has he changed his name? He's got a perfectly good name. That's right.
This was 20 years after the fact. He's still wondering why he's not called Ian McGeechy. And he's wearing a deer. I think, you know, it's a great image. He's wearing a deerstalker cap, and he's wearing full tweeds, and he's got a walking stick, and he walks down right to the front of the stalls by the stage, and he says, "That's me off, Ian. I'm off to the pub. Good work." And off he trots. So, you know, and you know, there was a strain of alcoholism in the family. His father, sadly, you know, did suffer from that as well. So, you know, a very eccentric guy. And I think there's an element of shame as well in some of that, I suppose. But, you know, John was 40 at that point or whatever. You know, it's mad. He's playing with big gigs in the Apollo in Glasgow, and his dad's...
Because the other thing about people who is the children of entertainers is the parents are always slightly jealous of them.
Mm.
Yeah, they always feel, I should get some of this attention. I produced this child. Do you know what I mean? I'm a professional as well. They've always that's always going
on. And also, you can't even sing properly. You know, you're slurring your words, yes. You know, enunciate, boy. There's a bit of that because they're, you know, they're singing Gilbert and Sullivan and in vaudeville.
Oh, yeah, because he sends vaudeville. Them the first record. He makes the first record when he's 19 and he sends them copies very much to say, I've achieved more than you've ever achieved because you were singers and where's your album?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely a bit of that. Yeah, I think he was very driven at that age. You know, that's probably a little bit off it, yeah.
It really struck me how quickly it all happened for him. You know, there's wonderful descriptions of him playing in Clive's folk club and the Crown in Scotland, you know, and how quickly the audiences attached themselves to him. So what was it about him that made him so special? You know, was it part of the act that he put on, the way he performed, or what was the package that connected with
him? I think it's a bit of that. I mean, he looked amazing. You know, at that age, he had this beautiful kind of curly blonde hair, and he was very striking. And I think, you know, he started to write very early. You know, he didn't. I mean, look at that. Wow. You know, he started to write because he wasn't really down with the folk scene in the traditional sense. He didn't want to play, you know, all the kind of classic traditional material. So he was starting to write really quickly. You know, his first gig, I think he played 3 of his own songs, and he'd only been playing the guitar for a year or so. So I think that probably, you know, marked him out a little bit. And he was, you know, he worked really hard. I think, you know, we look at him as this kind of maverick guy coming off the street with his guitar and plonking it down and just knocking it out. But, you know, a lot of people said to me, you know, he would restring his guitar every day. He would practice for hours. He'd lock himself in the room. So he was really, really good really quickly as well. And this weird style, you know, this very bluesy kind of guitar style, it was very powerful. It wasn't kind of wishy-washy, you know. It was really quite confrontational what he did. And he left really quickly. You know, he outgrew Glasgow within a year, and he went straight down to London. And so he was quite ambitious as well, quite driven, I think.
So tell us about the meeting with Beverly, how that all came together. And that's a key part in the book all the way through, the presence or absence of Beverly Martin. Tell us about that.
Well, of course, she was ahead of him, really. You know, she'd already made a few singles and records, and she was signed to Joe Boyd's Witch Season stable, you know, which is quite a prestigious thing. She played over in America. She'd been out with Paul Simon and Simon Garfunkel. She was doing pretty good things already. And then she met John. You know, she bumped into John. I think it was the Chelsea Arts Club. You know, he was playing, and she walked in and was like, "Ooh!" And it was this kind of instant chemical reaction between the two of them. And she already had a little son called Wesley. And I think very quickly, you know, there's lots of debate about whether John was very cynical about kind of jumping on her bandwagon and hitching a ride to where she was going. But I think, you know, he'd already made 2 records as well. So the idea, you know, they very quickly became a couple. And I think it was a natural development from there probably to make music together. So they went off to Woodstock in America. You know, this was Beverly's idea, or Joe Boyd's idea for Beverly, which was to go and make a record in America. John was like, yeah, I'll sign up to that. And he came along kind of as a guitar player and then started writing and started playing and started singing. And, you know, we had a duo album at the end of it. But I'm not sure it ever...
Do you think they were convincing, those records? I never got the impression as a kid listening to them that they were really about any kind of harmony. I mean, they looked... No. The cover was fantastic, the concept was perfect, but it didn't seem to be, like, you know, it didn't seem to be collaborative, really.
No, I don't think... I was just going to say, I don't think it ever really worked because, you know, they wrote individually. John was never in a band. You know, he was never one of these kids who was playing with his mates as a teenager. You know, he was always like, this is my vision for my music. So... I think it was quite expedient, probably, and didn't ever work. They sang their own songs. They would kind of chime in on the harmonies. I don't think the vocals ever really kind of connected very well. So, although, I mean, you look at the cover of Stormbringer and you think, these people are going to rule the world.
Absolutely.
One day.
You know,
beautiful. And it didn't fly. It just didn't. I think people can hear if something doesn't convince, because it's not really...
But they spent quite a lot of money, didn't they, on those first two records? And so it was the kind of... They sort of had to pay off those records, didn't they? And that had a really terrible effect on her career, didn't it? Because she never could make a record on her own. Is that fair?
Partly, I think that was partly the problem, because as John Wood said, Joe Boyd never had any problem spending money on a record. So, you know, he was double time for Leaving Home and flying to Woodstock and getting it mixed in the big studio. So it cost a lot of money. And all that was set against the, you know, future royalties. So, I mean, when John started making a bit of money with Solid Air, or at least selling some records, it all had to be, you know, it all had to be recouped against the advances.
They still had huge debts, didn't they, after Witch Season was sold to Ireland or whatever.
And so John had a kind of lifelong grudge against Joe Boyd. And also, I think
he had lifelong grudges against a lot of people.
He did. No, he blamed Joe Boyd for his lack of commercial success, which is unbelievably unkind, really.
And also Beverly, you know, he, I think, very unfairly kind of blamed Beverly in a sense for being part of that. And also, yes, it stopped her really from making her own records. Although John was instrumental in that as well, I think he certainly didn't encourage her to have a solo career.
So this record that I'm holding up for the benefit of anybody who's just listening to this is, of course, Solid Air. So this comes out. What year is this? I can't remember.
73,
which we all think of as being a kind of hit. You know, was it?
No. No, it wasn't a hit. But I don't think that wasn't the world of hits, was it? But for, you know, back then, I think it was. You know, they were the kind of artists who couldn't sell 50,000 records, which is a lot of records now, but back then was, you know, kind of below the radar in a way. And just toured. You know, John toured constantly. You know, he was always on the road. And he'd go on all the old Grey Whistle Test, and he'd
but that's the thing I wanted to talk about, because everybody remembers seeing John Martin on the Whistle Test doing May You Never. And it felt like everybody in the world went and bought that record afterwards. Well, clearly they didn't, but quite a lot of the long-haired people in the world, I suppose, went and bought it.
Well, I say in the book, it's almost like the David Bowie Starman.
It is.
It is.
A certain group of very kind of switched on listeners. You know, that was like, whoa. And actually Ralph McTell said, I saw that. I ran down to the record shop in Putney the next day. And the guy was like, nah, sold out, mate. It's Solid Air's already gone. So it did have that kind of massive impact. And he was very, very cool. You know, I think you hear all that stuff. And he also played I'd Rather Be the Devil, which was the whole Echoplex thing.
Yeah,
on that same show. And I think it was very attractive for a lot of people to see someone doing that just with a guitar. So, you know, he was very much a kind of cult artist, you know, but never sold a huge amount of records. No, and Solid Air, I'm sure it's sold a lot now because it's been a constant kind of catalog.
Yeah, but at the time it wouldn't have been a chart record. But
no. Wasn't it the same for all of them, wasn't it? I mean, Nick Drake, who he was great friends with, you know, Nick Drake, virtually no records at all, you know.
John Martin sold a lot more records than Nick Drake.
He did a lot more. So just very quickly, the Nick Drake section of the book is fascinating. Now, is that an attraction of opposites? Because I can't think of two more different characters who really...
Incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, what was the attraction for each, do you think?
Kind of weird fraternal kind of... bond, you know. Linda Thomas said it was very Greek, you know, it was like a love affair but just no sex. It was kind of he had very intense relationships with men, actually, John, you know, very kind of loving and tactile relationships with men. I think he recognized in Nick, well, I think he was curious about his music because Nick was so perfect, I think, in the way he played guitar, Nick Drake. You know, it was absolutely
precision.
Immaculate. Yeah, precision. Yeah. And John was, you know, different every time, bang, bang, bang. It was always great, but it was a kind of approximation. So I think he was fascinated by that. I think he was fascinated by the fact that Nick didn't seem to care about anything. Whereas I think John, excuse me, John was probably quite ambitious and did want people to like his music and wanted to be appreciated. Nick Drake seemed not to care about that at all in some ways.
Well, he was clearly ambitious and he went out and did all the things that Nick Drake refused to do. He went out at one point in the book, he goes out supporting Yes on a tour in America, which is just hysterical because he loathes and detests them, doesn't he?
He despises everything they stand for and the other things as well. Yeah, so he makes it his mission just to steal their women and their booze and their food while Yes are on stage and then just get out of it. And that's very John. You know, he doesn't try and win these audiences over. He's just like, this is my thing. I just imagine him in a stadium playing these wild Echoplex kind of instrumentals to 30,000, you know, frat boys in the Midwest. It must have been wild. So,
Do you think it's the case that he was one of those performers who was kind of frightened of being a success, really? That, you know, if he sensed that he could easily have had a kind of gone in a Ralph Mattel, Al Stewart route, couldn't he, with things like May You Never? But he just didn't dare go down that route, did he? He was always reversing away from success. Is that fair?
I think that's so true, yeah. I think that's absolutely the case. And there's you know, the examples of that, you know, someone else said, you know, he would always sack managers, you know, or if some important big management company came to visit him, he'd get completely shedded beforehand. So it would just sabotage the whole thing. So I think that's true. You know, so after Solid Air, you would expect him to kind of follow that up with a similar kind of album and a couple more of those kind of folk anthems that people could play in the folk club.
But he always found ways of blaming other people, didn't he? It was not his fault. It was Joe Boy's fault. It was the manager's fault. It was somebody who didn't support him, you know.
Yeah, or the musicians weren't feeling it, man. You know, they didn't tap into, you know, my vision. So, but I think that was a get-out clause. Yeah, I don't think he ever felt that. And probably just as well. God, can you imagine a John Martin who'd sold 5 million records? It would be terrifying.
How unbearable would he have become?
So, you know, it's probably self-preservation as well.
Yeah.
This is one of those books which could genuinely be described by the adjective unflinching. Because, you know, you've talked to, you know, his family, you've talked to the musicians who dealt with him. And a lot of what comes out is not a very pleasant person at all. Mm. You know, tell us about that.
Well, I was aware that, well, I think we're living in a kind of moment now culturally where the kind of roguish rock star behaviour is probably worn a little bit thin. You know, I don't think we can just kind of dismiss it as hijinks and, you know, he damaged people pretty seriously throughout his life. He damaged himself as well, but, you know, certainly inflicted a lot of damage on people. So I did want to be completely honest about that. And I was lucky, I think, that the people who were very close to him were really honest about it too, without kind of throwing him under the bus. You know, I think that, you know, there's a lot of affection still there for him, a lot of love for him amongst the people who were close to him, but they saw him very clearly. And, you know, you don't end up the way John Martin ended up. You don't end up with one leg and you know, at 55, he was a bit of a ruin when I first met him. And it doesn't happen by accident. You know, there has to be something going on there. And so I did want to be completely straight about that. And I was very clear with people I spoke to that, you know, I did encourage them to be as honest as possible without any sort of agenda.
No, it's very unvarnished, the whole account, and it's very, very honest. And you're not judgmental at all. It's just factual reporting on the kind of some of the monstrous things he did. But did it change the way you felt about him? I mean, how did that affect you doing all that research?
There was a few things. I mean, there are a few things that aren't in the book. But I think, you know, you get the picture of his behaviour. And, you know, I'd go back to the music. If it got a little bit too dark, I would listen to the music and kind of remind myself that, you know, he was a very rounded human being in many ways. And for all that he was monstrous and you know, aggressive and violent and abusive, which he was, he also made really beautiful music at his best. And I think that was also a reflection of who he was. He could be very warm and loving and all those other things. You know, it's not a black or white situation. I didn't want it to be that, you know, just to say this is a kind of either-or scenario. You know, he was a very complicated guy. So as much as I don't want to judge, and I don't want to whitewash, and I don't want to dismiss anything that he did, I did want to make sure that people kind of understood that there was many sides to his character.
When did you first meet him?
Well, it was all thanks to you guys. It was 2005. I was on a word mission to Thomastown and Kilkenny. I think there were some reissues. I think it was reissues of Stormbringer and The Road to Ruin that were coming out. So I went over there to meet him. And we spent the afternoon in the beer garden of the pub. It's actually, you know, the prologue of the book.
I remember the piece very well, yeah. And he was drinking huge amounts, very much kind of hail fellow well met, wasn't he, at the bar?
It was pints of cider, quadruple vodkas.
Oh, no!
A glug of
and then
cider,
breakfast. And
the vodka would go in the cider.
Oh.
And a cheese toastie just to, you know, for ballast. And, you know, that was lunch, you know, that was lunchtime. And he seemed unaffected by that. But so that was the first time I met him and did a kind of major interview with him for you guys. And it was brilliant. And he was, you know, very charming, very charismatic, very engaging, very, very bright, very funny. But, you know, underneath it all, you kind of looked at him and thought, Jesus, you know, because it was Stormbringer we were talking about. And you contrast the
beautiful,
angelic guy. In the
angelic, I know. Backlit like a halo. Yeah.
To this really kind of diminished human. You know?
One of the things that struck me most about the book is he always seems to find another woman to look after him. Mm-hmm. When he's screwed up so badly with the last one, you think that's it for the female sex, you know. Mm-hmm. This ruin still manages to get people, and they effectively look after him, don't they?
Yeah, they become carers, don't they, really?
They do, the one at the end. I mean, my goodness, yeah. It's just 24 hours a day, just sort of, you
know. Well, he doesn't have a house by that point. You know, I remember him saying, you know, September the 11th, 9/11, which was his birthday, 53rd birthday, and he gets a summons, you know, for repossession or whatever it is, and he... So at this point, he's living with Teresa, his last partner, in Ireland. That's why he's in Ireland, because he really has nowhere else to live. And, you know, it's old school. It's gig by gig, you know, week by week, cash by cash check. You know, it's that old troubadour.
Yeah.
Nothing strategic about John Martin's career, but always someone there to kind of mop up the mess because, as I say, he could be very charming, very charismatic. And I think when you have those songs in your armoury, that you can pull out and play to people, play to women. You know, there's always someone who's going to probably, you know, help you out.
So what surprised you most in researching this book? What did you find out that made you think about him differently?
I mean, his childhood, I think, was very interesting. I didn't really know the intricacies of that in terms of how young he was when he went to live with his dad and kind of how messed up he was, I think, by, you know, his mother not being around. But also, you know, there was another child. I discovered there was another child that he had in the late 70s, early 80s, that he completely abandoned. You know, it was a really, really sort of tragic story. And this child, when it's in his teens, wants to come and is interested in coming to meet him. And he just says, tell him I'm dead. You know, this absolutely cold refusal to look forward. And also, well, Lee Scratch Perry. I was going to show you my.
All right, go on. Man.
One World,
which I was playing only yesterday after having read your book, and I hadn't played it for years. It's a fantastic record.
Lee's on it. He's not actually credited on it, but the song "Big Muff" is a Lee Scratch Perry kind of production, and I interviewed him for the book, and he signed it. I don't know if you can see. He said, "Love, OK, Lee Scratch Perry."
Right.
But, you know, I don't know if you've interviewed Lee Scratch Perry. It's a fairly...
I'd love to. Although you get nothing out of him.
No, it took me about 3 months to transcribe it, but it was probably worth it. But what was interesting was he didn't know that John was dead, so I had to break the news to Lee Perry. Because I said, you know, let's talk about John Martin. He went, oh, how is John? I said, well, he's dead. And he went, oh. You know, he took it on the chin with equanimity. But you know, he was a very interesting interview, and so those kind
and
of
that was the period when, he, when Chris Blackwell got him to go over there to kind of decompress, didn't he? And say, come to Jamaica, drink some rum, come to Kingston, sit in a deck chair, smoke some weed and meet Lee Scratch Perry. And actually, it worked. I mean, it did work, didn't it? It suited him.
It got him out of that rut, I think, because, you know, you had Sunday's Child and Live at Leeds, and he's doing the, you know, the Echoplex and the acoustic guitar, and I think he's probably realising that it's starting to run out of road a little bit. That,
yeah.
And Chris Blackwell, I think, so astute and comes out of the book, I hope, quite well, because he's always kind of there to encourage John and to, you know, extend his patience to him much
longer. Oh, he's always saying there's a house on my estate you can live in. It's amazing. He's a
proper music man. So John goes off to Kingston in Strawberry Hill, which is where Bob Marley had recently been, you know, holed up after being shot. And he kind of formulates this record, which becomes One World, and he works with Lee Scratch Perry, and he appears on a number of reggae records that were recorded at that time, most of which no one quite, you know, the credits weren't nailed down, so we're not quite sure what they're on. And he's paid in, you know, pornographic movies and liqueurs and fake American dollars, and he has a great old time, and it kind of revitalizes him, and he comes back and makes One World. And then Lee Scratch Perry comes over to Chris Blackwell's farm in Reading and spends a day just kind of twisting knobs and working on the song Big Muff. We made Big Muff and we had Big Puff. That was his quote working practices at the farm. It's about as much the guy of him, actually. But it was great. So I think that's, and it's kind of telling about John. He was never content. I can't imagine Ralph McTell working with Lee Scratch Perry. You know what I mean?
No.
Not to put him down, but there's always that kind of need to sort of push things a little bit further than he needed to. Maybe.
Yeah. So tell us about the last years of John Martin, which were singularly tragic. He lost a limb.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a combination of it, really.
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, losing his right leg below the knee was the end of sort of 15 years of just, you know, his body being completely battered by various things, including a cow, which kind of splattered into his windscreen in Scotland. You know, so he.
But wasn't that because he was driving? If I remember right, he was driving kind of drunk, and he decided he still wanted to carry on driving. So he thought if he turned the car lights off, the police wouldn't see him. Wasn't that right? He was driving, I think, in the dark and just hit a cow.
Yeah, not far from here. And he didn't have a license. He wasn't legally allowed to drive.
Yeah.
So, he was coming down the country lanes back from whatever pub he'd been in and hit a cow. He impaled himself on a fence post and punctured his lung. He had pancreatitis. Lots and lots of things. You know, broke toes. His face, I mean, when you saw him up close at that time, it was just kind of roadmap of just destruction, you know, self-destruction. So he was very, very much diminished. And at that point was, a helpless alcoholic. You know, I mean, he took pretty much every drug going, but I think alcohol was the one that really got its claws on him, and his daughter certainly thought that. And, you know, she said to me that, you know, if there was a time when John could have sorted it out, when he got his leg amputated, you know, that would have been a point where most people might have gone, well, hang on, maybe, you know, it's time to curb my appetites a little bit. And he maybe could have cleaned up a bit. But he wasn't built that way. You know?
He never modified his behaviour at all. He just, nothing made him change.
He would water his wine, you know, he'd water his wine at breakfast if he was slowing down a bit. You know?
Right. Well, so while we're talking about the drink, I'm very grateful to your book for the information that from Linda Thompson, that back in the day, Richard Thompson was the one who could drink everybody under the table. I'd never heard of this side of him before. You know,
hollow legs.
Yes.
Can you imagine?
You cannot imagine that at all. No. But of course,
he converted to Sufism, and I guess that all went out the window. Yeah.
So he clearly hasn't had a drink for a long time. Yeah. While we're talking about the drink, I think, Alex, we've got Keith, who's got a question about John Martin's actual drink intake. Yes, he says there were 2-pint glasses on his monitor, allegedly filled with port and red wine, both finished during the show. Can you confirm that that was the case? Port and red wine?
Yeah, almost certainly. I mean, he drank these extraordinary combinations as well. He drank rum and orange. Has anyone ever heard of rum and orange?
Oh, yeah, that's awful, isn't it? Yeah, I have. It's a 70s
rum
thing,
and orange,
yeah.
Cider and vodka, port and What was it? What was the mixer? Port and
well, that was port and red wine. But the point is, they were pint mugs. So to drink a pint of port or a pint of red wine would be fairly fairly relaxing, wouldn't it? I would have thought.
Yeah. I mean, when he was in hospital, you know, there's great stories about people going in to visit him, you know, completely straight, and they'd come out absolutely smashed. Yes. Because, you know, you'd have 2 liter bottles of Coke filled with Bacardi with a little bit of Coke, and he'd have one of these builder belts, you know, that you get builder belts for putting tools in. They're just full of Coke. So yeah, I mean, port and wine certainly, no problem at all. There's a great. I'm going to show you a little postcard I got from one of his many managers. Sandy Robertson, and this is
An Anton Corbijn photo.
Anton Corbijn's wonderful picture. And he just wrote a little thing on the back, and he wrote, "Looks like fun, eh?" And that was his comment on managing John Martin.
Isn't there a bit in the book where he stops managing John Martin because he just can't deal with it any longer, and then gets a call about a week later saying, "Oh, I'm in Europe. I just want to check that you've sorted out my travel insurance or my health insurance, whatever." He said, "No, I don't manage you anymore. Stop ringing me."
He's like, "John, you actually attacked me in a hotel room in Chicago and broke 2 of my ribs. We're finished." And John's he's in Nassau, actually, in the Bahamas, and going, "Yeah, my health insurance, Sandy, is it all sorted out?" And Sandy's like, "Not my job now, mate. You know, someone else has got to do that." And I'm sure someone else did. But Sandy, he lasted about 2 years and just, it ended in fisticuffs and rancor, I think. But that was his comment. "Looks like fun, eh?" And I was like,
"Yeah." What is it about the music you think just is still so enduring? Because it still sounds fabulous. What is it that you find so attractive?
I think it's a few things. I think one thing he did brilliantly was he made records. You know, where lots of other people from that generation and, you know, from the folk clubs nominally, maybe just brought their show into the studio and were content to just play the songs. You know, you listen to Solid Air and it's a proper record. You know, it's produced, it's arranged, it's got wonderful textures on it. And so I think it endures in a way that lots of other records don't. And just the fact that he brought in so much other material, you know, kind of free jazz, you know, the whole Ekaplex thing is so interesting because it's one, you know, a guy who's playing the guitar and thinks, "I'm on stage on my own. That's not going to change. I'm not going to get a band. How do I change the sound of what I do? How can I kind of expand the limitations of one man and an acoustic guitar?" And so, you know, he develops this incredible...
Which The Edge must have borrowed from heavily, you suggest.
Listened to it,
and he did, didn't he?
Chris Blackwell might have put a few copies of something under the door.
He probably did, that's right.
I think you say that his best-selling record was one of these two, wasn't it? What have I got? Well Kept Secret and Glorious Fool. Which one was the... One of these was a top 20 album.
Well Kept Secret, I think, got to number 20. Which is probably one of his weakest records. This was his time when he was making these kind of strange sub-Phil Collins kind of shiny commercial soul records. And that was his biggest chart placing, number 20 in the early 80s.
I suppose that's what happens when you get a big record company working on your behalf rather than a small one, isn't it? They get you into the shops, don't you? So
well, if there is any... Danny said, you know, I got a call from his manager going, you know, "You're out. We want him to be the new Van Morrison. We want him to play this kind of with a band." But he seemed to be behind that. I don't think John would have done anything he wasn't kind of massively, into musically. So I think there was a part of him that quite fancied wearing the suit and slicking the hair back and playing these kind of soul music.
Van Morrison is the obvious parallel, isn't it, really? You know, they're very... I mean, Van Morrison, legendarily difficult, not as difficult as John Martin, I think it's fair to say. But, you know, did his own thing. But Van Morrison, you know, A, he's still with us, and B, he can still play big halls, can't he? You know, and he's never bothered a chart anywhere, really, has he? You know,
no.
What is it about John Martin that meant that was impossible for him? That kind of success.
Well, I think, you know, Van's he's quite conservative musically, isn't he? You know, he sticks to kind of blues and folk and soul structures. John, especially in that period in the 80s, it's really strange music. You know, it's very kind of discordant and
very experimental.
Yeah, the textures are really
weird. It takes a huge amount of getting used to.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think he's much further out there than Van Morrison. I think if he had just played the game and his voice was so beautiful, you know, he just played simpler songs, perhaps, and, you know, turned up, and you could guarantee that he would play a good show every night. I mean, some of the shows, there's that great story about him I think it's the Mean Fiddler, 1987, where he comes on 3 hours late, plays one song, vomits into a bucket on the side of the stage, and then departs. You know, and I don't think Van's ever done that. So, you know, I think
fair.
People had their fingers burned by John Martin, and as time goes on, you see less and less people, I think, willing to stick their neck out for him.
Yeah.
So the kind of industry support wasn't there.
Yeah. So looking back on, you know, his all his records, what's the one that you think people should go back to and, you know, to experience the full majesty of John Martin? What's the one that you yourself would recommend?
I think before he kind of lost his innocence in a way, you know, Bless the Weather for me is, in terms of the songs, there's something very pure about that record. You know, it's not the most innovative musically because he hasn't sort of developed a lot of the things that he would go on to do in the 70s. But there's something, he's still only, what, 21, I think, when he made that. You know, he's incredibly young. He looks fantastic. And there's a real, it's almost the kind of English side of him. You know, that side we talked about from his mother's side, you know, that sort of Surrey, that rural kind of green England side of him, which I find very attractive. You really hear it on that record, Going Down the River, you know, those kind of songs where he's really touched. He's really tuned into a very kind of elemental thing. And so it, to me, it's a sort of time before he turned into something different, something a bit wilder maybe, but that record's very kind of pure.
Right, right.
And you should mention that there are people, various folk musicians, Corinne Polwart and various others, who are doing wonderful covers of his songs to promote your book, to coincide with its publication.
They are, yeah. Thanks, Mark. Yeah, we commissioned five artists to do... pick a cover of a John Martin song, film it, and we put it up via Folk Radio, which is an online website. So it's wonderful. Yeah, I mean, we've got some lovely versions of From One World, but Couldn't Love You More, which Corinne's done, which is up today, and Fine Lines, which is another lovely song. We've got a couple coming tomorrow from Solid Air. People do love his music. You know, it's he is someone, I think, who, you know, not a huge amount of people are tuned to John Martin, but when people are, I think they really do love him.
He's probably one of those artists who probably his popularity is probably growing steadily. You know what I mean? Like Nick Drake and all those things. You know, because there is a public for that kind of thing, and it's not all old gits like me. You know, it's people in their 20s and 30s are drawn.
Completely. Nick Drake was adopted by a whole generation of teenagers and people in their early 20s.
I mean, I suppose the good thing about Nick Drake is that it's a very slim catalogue, isn't it? And it's very neat.
Yes.
And the story's very
neat. It's a perfect catalogue. Yeah, you can't go wrong with
there's
Nick
no Drake. Bad record. That's
no
right.
Bad
decline.
Record, 3 years.
Whereas, you know, John's is a huge kind of messy explosion of lots of different type of music. But, you know, Solid Air, we saw it kind of in the 90s, you know, with this whole trip-hop thing. You know, Solid Air sort of got picked up as the extension or the foundations of a lot of those, you know, Portishead and Massive Attack. You can hear the same kind of rhythms and the same kind of atmosphere, I think, in songs. So it would be nice, I think, if more people, because it's very fresh, you know, they're quite timeless sounding records. Those good records in the 70s, you know, the best ones are still pretty.
They are. They are. Well, look, it's a fantastic piece of work. Small Hours, Graham Thompson, The Long Night of John Martin, and I thoroughly recommend it to anybody. Anybody who's a fan of John Martin, but also anybody who's interested in the kind of... Yeah, there you go. That's
all right. Three of us. Three of us. That's great.
But anybody who's interested in the kind of psychology of performers and, you know, why they're not always the most pleasant people. And that can be part of the deal, you know, in what makes them great artists. It's really well examined there. And I think it does a really good job. What are you working on next, Graham?
Nothing at the moment. No, I'm taking a little...
Twiddling his thumbs. I'm taking a little break in his study at home.
Yeah. It took a while, this book. You know, it took longer than I thought it might, because for some of those reasons you just said.
Well, you talked to so many people. I mean, you know, you tracked down ex-wives and children and an immense number of people who worked with him, all those people who influenced him in the early days. It was a really thorough, comprehensive thing.
Just trying to kind of get him, you know, get it right. You know,
it's
difficult when someone's that kind of complicated and quite extreme. You don't want to, you want to try and get it right. So I'm taking a little break from, you know, dark side of the street.
Okay. That's a good place to end. That's a good place to end. Thanks very much for everybody who's been with us. And thanks very much to Graham. And this will be going up on YouTube and as an audio podcast in the next few days. It'll be, you know, out there. All the very best, Graham. Cheers.
Very good. Thanks, Graham, very much.
Bye.
See you soon. Bye.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.